And will Valfourie all fall?
So when the aircraft were at about 30 miles, we locked on with the 909s, one on each target, and they were only separate by about half a mile or so. And we fired the first missile, and it shot away, and a beautiful sight with this efflux, and you'd see the missile, and there were various photographs taken of this. Great cheers from the ships at anchor around us. And you could see the whole thing happen. You could see the missile fly out, you could see the contrails of the aircraft coming in, and the explosion when the first missile hit the Learjet. We'd fired a second missile almost immediately, and this had an equally dramatic course, but it went wild. And instead of going up the track to the second aircraft, it shot straight for Ajax Bay and the hospital and landed in the hill about 100 yards above the hospital. And I learnt the next day, in talking to the doctors and people, that they all rushed out to see this great missile fly up of ours, because it takes a couple of minutes to get there. But they all rushed in again, rather like a Monty Python scene, when they saw the second one coming straight towards them. And it landed, and it, for a long time, was just stuck with its nose firmly into the hillside. So that was a near miss. We were furious what had happened to the system. Well, we were to find out later. But the second aircraft, discretion was the better part of valor, turned and ran. And by the time we had realized that we'd had a system fault, we decided that it was a waste of a missile to take it out at such long range, and we might well have missed. We had now proven that the CDART system operated at its extreme end of its missile envelope, with a successful firing at about 30 miles at 30,000 feet. So again, we were very pleased, but we were furious that the second missile had gone wild. And we were to learn, mainly due to the dogged determination of one young Lieutenant W.E., you know, weapons officer, who was absolutely certain that this was a software corruption and there was nothing wrong with his system. So we believed him, and we sent a whole lot of messages off, we eventually got a very sad message from the Admiralty Signal Weapons Establishment at Portsmouth saying, yes, that's quite correct. If you fire two missiles within a certain time scale on the two systems, one will go ballistic. And this is a known software defect, which was discovered in the Bristol firings 5 years earlier, had not been rectified in our software program. Well, Balfour went ballistic about this. But, I mean, it was too late. The software correction was signalled to us 2 days later, which shows that if you want to, you can respond very quickly to this sort of experience. And it taught us a lesson that even in war, you want to have an iterative relationship with the research establishments and industry, so that if you do find a defect, you can work out what it was. The Bland's battle had sort of gone dead, as it were. Army were positioning for the attack on Stanley. Everyone was getting worried that there would be a lot of casualties. Most people were getting worried about another air raid. There were difficulties over getting fire brigade into position. And just to see a missile go off from Carlos Water, I think, cheered everybody up a lot. It certainly cheered all of us up. Our patience waiting for the next raid was duly rewarded. Later that, the next day, I decided I would whip round and talk to the COs, because we were having some problems of trying to coordinate the use of all the escorts that were inshore, and particularly their helicopters. And one or two of us felt that we were wasting our assets, and there was lots more we could do. But it was, again, the command in Fearless was very, very busy. And we were trying to be helpful and say, well, look, would you like to use this and this and this? And my helicopter had gone off with a new infrared sensor to help the special forces. And we had suggested helicopters could provide a decoy for any attack on Stanley. And these things were being discussed, and the best way was to nip around. So I spent the morning flying around my helicopter, and I ended up for lunch in Plymouth. And the captain, his old friend, David Pentree, said, well, I've just been told to go out and bombard the West Falkland observation post. And believe it or not, there was still an Argentinian observation post within sight of Colas Water in West Falkland. And why it was never taken out, I never understood. Why it hadn't been attacked and removed, I don't know. But they were getting very useful intelligence of what we were doing. So he went, he said, well, after lunch, why don't you stay on board and we'll give you a demonstration of this new thing called Flasher, which was in fact a sort of crude laser-type weapon, which I think is well known now, and it was just a means that maybe one could blind the pilot of a fighter ground attack if you were short of close-range weapons. And so I said, now I think I better get back to my ship just in case something happens. And I shot back to the ship actually in a boat, fast boat, and I'd only been on board about 10 minutes when we had warning of a raid. And we had all got quite used to these alertments for raids, and we were beginning to calculate quite carefully. And one of the calculations is when you get your aircraft airborne to counter a raid from the forward operating base, what you do with your cap from the carriers so that they don't run out of fuel just at the moment when you need them. And this is an old problem of getting aircraft up. Too early and they run out of fuel at the crucial moment. Too late, they're not there for the job. There's nothing new in this problem. But it was the first time I'd had to worry about it for real. Well, we decided to launch a cap at 5 o'clock, 1700 in the evening, and at 2 minutes to, Plymouth, who was out bombarding, was attacked. So we got that wrong. But fortunately, the aircraft were early, and they were actually airborne when the raid came in on Plymouth. The raid actually had come in low in the middle, split, gone north, up the sound, was going to attack the forward operating base and Colas Water, but had seen Plymouth, and all 5 aircraft dropped 2 bombs each, 10 around Plymouth. And she did a very good job in neutralizing the damage and looking after herself, put a fire out, and was remained operational. The Harriers got 2 of the raid, and the Rapiers got 1. So it wasn't a total disaster. And so we thought, well, that's the raid. But being able to see nothing else on our radars and no warning of anything else, we were totally unaware that, in fact, a second element of the raid was coming in low, and now we know this from the Argentinian stories, and this was the raid that went to Buff Cove. We had passed air raid warning red, which means a raid is imminent, to everybody, including the two LSLs that were down at Buff Cove. And I had talked to Captain Green in the Tristram the day before and said, well, look, we'll warn you, but we couldn't hear any reply, and we were all on HF. So we broadcast this message that there was an air raid coming. But sadly, history relates that the message never got through. And I always regret to this day that we didn't send a complimentary or a confirmatory message by teleprinter saying, you know, heads up, there might be a raid. But having seen the Mirage's attack Plymouth, we thought, well, that's probably about all the Argentinians will mount that day. But we were quite wrong. The raid on Buff Cave is well catalogued elsewhere, but it was a worry to me. I had an interesting discussion I got home with a lady from the press, Granada Television, who wanted to try and suggest that we had failed, which I suppose to some extent we had, in retrospect. And she kept pestering me. So I said, are you a racing girl? And she said, yes, I am, actually. And I said, well, I like going to races too. I said, are you rich? And she said, no, I'm not. I said, well, you see, you have the same problem as I did in Colas Water. You look at the horses, you look at the form, you study the race course, and you decide what's going to happen. And you put your money on it. And you're surprised that it doesn't quite work out as everyone had predicted. Well, he said, it's exactly the same in war. You look at the situation, you look at your resources, you have all the experience, and you put your money on what's going to happen, And sometimes it doesn't work. And I said, that's exactly what happened that day. We didn't know there was another raid. If we had, we'd have put the cap over the thing and dealt with it. Invincible didn't know there was another raid, and her cap was Ava Stanley. So that's how it works. And the nice girl did say, well, I think your analogies made your point and left me alone. But it's very true. It's so easy to suggest afterwards that you should have known. But on the day, you have to go for what you think is happening. And it comes back to this dreadful point that we had no low air warning. All it needed was one radar on top of a hill near Carlos. Even a crude sort of radar with one bloke saying, heads up, raid, 50 miles west. That's all you needed. And we didn't have it. And this was our biggest disadvantage throughout the whole operation. We just did not have it. The Argentinians did. They had a brand new, very smart French radar. And we spent our time trying to destroy it. What we should have done was try and capture it and use it. However, that's a lesson learned. So the day, there was one more raid that day, and this was a high-level raid, which was a whole lot of Mirages, about six of them, and they came in high, and this was a distraction for the raid on Buff Cove. Now, we saw this on our radar. We'd sent Invincible's cap to attack it, and we locked on, and we had a very interesting professional game with these aircraft. We put the cap in to attack it and then withdrew them if they couldn't catch them. We then allowed the Argentinians to come back in again and locked on with our 909s to try and shoot them down, holding the cap off, hoping that that would either kill them or bring them in closer and certainly deter them. And we played cat and mouse with four Harriers and these six Mirage. And two of them were shot down, I think, with this little game. But it was a very interesting and technical experience of how, if you're well worked up and you understand the aircraft and your own system, you can play a missile system within 2 or 3 degrees of bearing, knowing all the time who's where, what's happening, and there's no risk of a blue-on-blue. But the key thing is that you have control of the aircraft. And we had an aircraft controller on board who was well known to the aircraft. They trusted him, and our missile system was sufficiently worked up we could do that. And it was an interesting demonstration of what you can achieve with these complex modern systems once you trust them and you have the experience and expertise. So that was, it was a very interesting day. It was a very sad day for the Welsh Guards. We were very upset that we had been unable to provide the air defence coordination required, but we don't have a conscience. Not really. After that, the main attack on Stanley went in. We went back to the battle group. Cardiff came in to relieve us. She had her own problems of trying to identify aircraft. Her main role was to try and get this low aircraft coming in with resupply at night for the Argentinians, and the high-level attacks, which were ineffective from the Canberras. They were just dropping bombs from the height and not hitting anybody. So it was a deterrent rather than any serious threat to us. And we went back to look after battle group whilst all the other escorts were busy on the gun line. And they were firing as many as 1,000 shells a night in naval gunfire support, which was an interesting reminder of an old naval capability, which is so frequently, in policy terms, poo-pooed as not really being necessary in modern warfare. But certainly in the Falklands, it was extremely effective and very important contribution to the artillery bombardment prior to an attack. And the ships, one of the ships, actually, one of the Type 21s, actually wore out her gun barrel completely. She had to retire. and the barrel was no longer safe. And she'd fired so many rounds. But everyone had made their contribution. And so now our job was just to sit offshore. We began more and more to believe that there were no more exits, and the evidence was building up to that. So although we were still very alert, we were more comfortable offshore, and we would have preferred to remain inshore, having got to know the place, and with provided the continuity of just knowing what was going on there and how to help without being a nuisance. But it was not to be. We were brought back. But he did give me an opportunity to call on Sandy Woodward and explain to him how different it was and try and pass on some of the things that were worrying the shore end, which he might have been able to alleviate, particularly the wish for the carriers to come a good deal closer for the final sort of 3 or 4 days so that they could provide the air support required. Everybody was now very worried that the rate of attrition had gone up, and we'd lost the LSLs, we'd had serious problems with the Welsh Guards, and this was giving us adverse morale problems, and I think it was a critical period for Sandy Woodward, but he was adamant that he had to remain afloat and he couldn't go ashore. I think it revealed this difficulty he'd had all along of being able to leave his flagship in the sure knowledge that his policies would be carried out in the same way as he wanted them to be. He was never quite sure that his staff captains and his flag captain in Hermes were going to react as he would wish. But I think that probably is as much the Submariner in him and his character as anything else. I don't think it was as such a personality clash. It's just a different background of how you operate. So that was really all that Exeter was involved in. The rest was elsewhere. When the whole thing was over, we went inshore, and 2 or 3 days after it was all over, and the day before we were sent home, we went in to visit Stanley, because Exeter, as you might recall, was seriously damaged in the Graff's Bay incident, the River Plate, and went to the Falklands to bury some of her dead and repair herself and make mock guns and things in order to get a passage home. And it was only Churchill who actually saved the old Exeter from being sunk in the Falklands waters and chaps brought home in another ship, because he thought it was good for morale of the country to see the ship come home and celebrate her return. And Exeter's always had a soft spot for the Falklands and vice versa. So we had this strange ship visit. We reverted to our peacetime role. We cleaned up the ship. We wore our blue uniforms. We had a service of thanksgiving in the church. We gave a small reception in the hangar. It was actually quite cold by then. And all the soldiers in their dirty fatigues and the mud of the streets of Stanley couldn't really understand what on earth was going on. Who were these sailors wearing blue suits and looking smart and talking and having a drink in the pub and all these sort of things? It was most extraordinary. And then that lasted a day, and then we slipped out again and went back into our readiness routine. But we thought it was a gesture, and also an important way of signalling normality, that the thing was over. There was no way the Argentinians were going to have another crack at us, and that we ought to unwind. And this was one way of signalling, not only to my own ship's company, but to others, that, hey, relax, chaps, a bit. Don't become stupid and complacent, but come off the peak bit and start cruising and calm down and generally sort of pay attention to things. There were a lot to be done, a lot of maintenance, a lot of things that couldn't be done when you were at high state of alert, and get back into that sort of attitude of mind. And I think that was a very important thing for the command to do, was to try and re-establish what you might call controlled calm, but still maintain the alertness necessary in case you get caught by surprise. And then we all waited to see when we were going to come home. We all wanted to go home. There was a surprising feeling, and I had it myself very positively, that it was all over, let's go home, what's the fuss about? And we were intolerant, I think, of the command's wish that the presence should be maintained and a high-level presence, and we were, I think in retrospect, probably slightly punched drunk, the thing was over and we ought to go home. However, we were lucky to go home quite soon, not as early as some of. The passage home was uneventful, except for trying to tell our families when we were coming. There was a blanket of security. We weren't to tell anybody. We weren't told ourselves when we had to come back. I eventually squeezed out of Northwood a date. But I was told in no circumstances would I tell the families. Well, it was going to be August. So I thought, well, it would be awful if we came home and find all the wives had gone off on holiday. And anyway, it's always good for families to be able to know when you're coming back, because not all families are as orderly as the others. So it's nice for people to get themselves tidied up and ready. So how on earth could I tell them? Well, it suddenly dawned on me. My wife and I had both had dado pad diaries for some time. And this is a diary with lots of funny pictures in it and drawings. And each page is a page of the diary, Monday to Sunday. And on the opposite page is a drawing or a picture, which is a cartoon or something funny. It suddenly dawned on me that I could send a signal, which no one would be able to decrypt, in plain, to Sheila, saying about families, and if I quoted the dodo pad, so I sent to her that we weren't sure we were coming home, but keep dodo and the drawing name, whatever it was, clear, and make sure everybody's around. Don't let people go on holiday. And this worried my chief yeoman, and he never broke the code until the day I left the ship, nearly a year later. And he said to me, sir, before you go, can you tell me, there's one thing that's puzzled all of us, we've never been able to work out how the families knew when we were getting home, because rumour was rife, and everyone was saying it was going to be something different, and I knew the answer. How did your wife know? I said, it was the dodo signal. He said, but what did it mean? I said, well, look, here you are, Chief. It's been lying on my desk for a year. Oh, he said, how on earth did I not bail that out? I said, well, nobody else did either. So we got away with it.
And it worked.
And it worked. So good for Sheila, who was intelligent and immediately spotted what it was. And so at least all our family and friends were ready to meet us. And what an extraordinary day that was, arriving in Portsmouth with Cardiff and company. We'd come back with Yarmouth, and she'd gone up to Scotland. We'd had a pleasant trip home, a lot of reminiscing, and Yarmouth had done a marvellous job. The Type 12s had been excellent ships. She and Plymouth had really earned their pay, and we thought, as first reserves, Cardiff and ourselves hadn't done too badly. And when we saw the welcome in Portsmouth Harbour, it did bring tears to your eyes. It was extremely emotional. My family were in a boat, in the harbour master's boat. I saw my brother-in-law waving an envelope, which I knew was in it, and throw it over the side. So that was good. And that was the letter I had written to him from Ascension. I was so overwhelmed by this, I actually forgot that I was about to put the ship alongside. And we came alongside the jetty faster than I've ever done before. Unfortunately, not without incident, so that was okay. But I very nearly ended up this whole trip by ramming my ship into the jetty, because I had A, tears in my eyes, and B, I was staggered by the amazing welcome, which I think all the commanding officers were, of crowds and crowds and crowds of people. And we all felt very humble that we'd done our bit. We hoped we'd done it satisfactorily, and we were very proud of the battle honour awarded to the ship. And we were very relieved that we had no damage and no casualties. So our 6-week wonder was full of instant humour difficult decisions, the most of which were human rather than technical, which only goes to show that nothing really changes with modern weapon systems. In the end, it comes down to the human decisions of whether you're on watch or whether you're at action stations, whether your people are happy, whether they're worried. And I recalled on our way back, we had a memorial service on board, a sort of Thanksgiving service with the chaplain, to which every member of the ship's company attended. And it's interesting at sea, sailors don't mind going to church at sea, provided the parson doesn't take the service, because he goes on too long. But on this occasion, they were all there, and we all sang lustily, and thank God for our safe return. And we were very sad that so many people had failed to come back, but felt that on balance, really, considering the losses, there had been very little loss of life, and we were very grateful for our safe return. And I think reflecting on the Falklands, we were surprised at how many old lessons were learned, and really how few new lessons appeared.